Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell. Today I'm bringing to you Professor Margot Mountjoy from McMaster University in Canada to talk about the very important topic of harassment, abuse and mental illness in athletes. So Margot has an amazing background. She started off as a synchronized swimmer, which I think is called artistic swimming now, and then became a sports medicine doctor and was doing research around the area, but then formalized it by doing a PhD, and she has an amazing, you know, number of papers around harassment, abuse, and mental illness. But also she's a leader in REDS, so relative energy deficiency in sport, where she's put together consensus statements, et cetera. And as we talk about, they can overlap to some extent. So she's a very, you know, accomplished person. She's actually also the Dean of Medicine at McMaster. So I was really happy to have her, you know, sit down and take time to take us through these important issues. So, you know, we talked about all sorts of different types of harassment, abuse, and the mental illness effects they can have. We talked about hopefully things are improving in this regard with, you know, especially we discussed some high sort of profile cases that have been in the media in the last few years. And you'll see throughout that Margot is really caring and empathetic, and that this, you know, topic means a lot to her. So I think this is a really important one. So hopefully you'll stick around for this and find it as interesting and as important as I did. Hi, Margot. How are you? Thanks for coming on Inside Exercise.
I'm very well, thanks. And thank you for the kind invitation. It's a pleasure to chat with you today, Glenn.
Oh, that's great. So, you know, I've seen that you've been very highly cited and you speak all over the place. Indeed, before we came on, I said, have you been to Australia? And why don't you tell us where you've been in Australia again? It gives us an idea of how much you get around and talk.
Well, I've spoken at a conference in the Gold Coast. I've spoken at a conference in Canberra, and I've worked at World Championships in Melbourne, and I've had the pleasure of just enjoying Cairns.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. So Melbourne is where I usually am, but I'm actually up in Sydney at a friend's house for various reasons at the moment, so different setup, but and the light's coming in from the side, which I don't normally have. But yeah, so what I often start off asking people is, you know, how they got in to the research they're doing. And often it's like, you know, were you a sports person first and then you got interested in research, or were you a researcher and then got interested in exercise and sport? And I guess with you, you're a medical doctor as well, so I'm wondering how did you start off a medical doctor and then you ended up in sports? Or, you know, if you could explain that to us a little bit, it'd be interesting.
I'd be most happy to, Glenn. I was an elite artistic swimmer at the time known as synchronized swimmer. So I traveled all over the world for Canada competing in that sport. And I left the sport, closed the chapter on sport to enter my new chapter in life, which was on medicine. Not realizing that, in fact, I didn't have to close the chapter on sport, that I could actually meld my two loves together, which is sport and health, through sport medicine. So I started quite early in my career, before I actually had qualified, traveling with Team Canada as a team physician, which I'd done for several decades on different sports teams. And then I got involved at the international federation level through work with FINA, which led to work with IOC, which led to work with WADA and World Rugby, FIFA, and golf. I left my family practice. I had a part-time family practice, part-time sport medicine practice, and I left after 20 odd years to pursue a PhD and actually get some credibility for the research that I was already doing. And so my research career was relatively late in life and really stemmed from the sport medicine work I'd been doing already. So it's a little bit of a convoluted story, but they actually all meld together in a logical, at least for me, logical pathway.
So you were elite. So were you in the, I don't know, Canadian team or something? I don't know.
Yes, I was on a Canadian team and I competed internationally, but I wasn't on the top team, which means I had less pressure than the ones that were on the top team. And I retired just before it came into the Olympic program. So I didn't compete at the Olympic Games, although I've had the distinct honor and pleasure of actually attending the Olympic Games for the IOC. Gosh, since 2000, I think I've been at every summer Olympic Games since 2000, which of course Sydney was my first Olympic Games. And I've done a few winter games, 2006, 10, and 14 were my winter games. Wow. So distinct pleasure.
You wouldn't believe it, but, you know, Australia's usually, you know, we're on the wrong time zone. We're in the wrong, you know, hemisphere for most of these things. And just my luck, I didn't even think about it. But when the Sydney Olympics was on, and I'd been brought up in Sydney and lived in Melbourne, I was in the US at a conference. So it was the wrong time and everything again. But that must have been
pretty special. Well, it was a fabulous games. It was a fabulous games. And it was my first. So it was very special. But, you know, the Aussies should be very proud of the job they did.
I've just got continual shivers up my spine thinking about when Cathy Freeman won the 400, the Aboriginal.
Spectacular. Yeah, spectacular.
All right, so I'm wondering.
That was, of course, in the time of Ian Thorpe, the torpedo.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
So that was
one. Yeah, amazing swimmer. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't help thinking, you know, as well, like how you ended up, you know, looking at. I know you do a lot of Red S research, and I've already had Trent Stellingworth on the podcast, which you've just headed up. I know a whole bunch of papers and consensus statements, and maybe we'll talk about that a bit later. But I'm wondering, I'm hoping it wasn't from personal abuse or whatever that you got into harassment, abuse, and mental health in athletes. But I couldn't help wondering how you got into that area as well.
Great. Well, thank you for the question. Mm-hmm. And maybe I just might give your listeners a heads up that we will be talking about harassment, abuse in sport. And for some, it may be a triggering topic. And so I just want to give people the heads up that, if they need help, I'm sure there's local help through their healthcare delivery system, wherever they're listening, if they wish to have help. And I just want to give people the notification. Yeah. So you asked how I got involved personally in this aspect of sport medicine and sport research, sport science research. And I think it probably stemmed back to my first world championships. And I was working in Rome in 1994, and I was there with Team Canada. And it was my first world championships where I was actually, so as you know, my background was with artistic swimming, but as the doc for Team Canada, I was also to cover water polo, diving, and swimming, which are the other aquatic sports at world championships. Mm-hmm. So it was my very first water polo event that I was attending. And I was watching them play, and the team captain missed the goal, and she came out of the water, and the coach punched her in the face for missing the goal.
What? No.
And I was a very young physician at the time. I mean, I was really new. And I was dumbfounded. I've never seen that kind of behavior before. And I was just appalled. And I, of course, made sure she was okay. She brushed me off. It's part of the game. And I felt powerless to do anything. I didn't know what to do. I knew it didn't sit well with me, but I didn't know what to do. And then I didn't act. I didn't have a mechanism to act. I didn't know what to do. And then fast forward a decade, and I started working at the International Olympic Committee. And it was right around the time that Sheldon Kennedy, and your listeners may or may not know him, he's an NHL ice hockey player who came forward with allegations of sexual abuse for many years. So a Canadian NHL, so very dear to me as a Canadian. And the Ice Hockey Federation approached the IOC that something needs to be done in this aspect of sport. And the then president of International Ice Hockey Federation said, yes, we need to do something about it. And he looked down the table and said, Margot, as a Canadian, I think you should be the one doing this. And so it just kind of landed in my lap, but appropriately, because I was very much in tune to ensuring that as a sport medicine physician, I looked after the entire athlete, not just their ACL or their shoulder, but their entire health and as a human being, mental health, physical health, and safety. So from then on, I led the IOC consensus statement on sexual harassment abuse 2007. Fast forward 10 years, it wasn't a fast 10 years of advocacy work to have the Rio 2016, the first games where the IOC had a safeguarding framework. And in 2016, we rewrote the consensus statement to expand beyond sexual harassment to include the other forms. So that's a little trip down memory lane for me on how I got involved in this field, and really saw a need. And when I see a gap and a need, that's when I like to act.
Yes.
Same with REDS, same with mental health, where there's a gap, same with female athlete health, where there's a gap and a need, that's where you'll find
Margot. Well, that just that had a real emotional effect on me. I was just blown away when you said the way we put up the video is gallery, so you don't actually see, you know, when mm-hmm. I'm talking, you can see me, and when you're talking, you can see you. So people wouldn't have seen, but I was when you said punched in the face, and then the other thing was, I mean, that's horrible, and just I can't imagine. I'm like, hang on a minute, like in front of people, just so many things went through my head, but then it's almost as bad that the female athlete kind of brushed it off and said it's part of the game, like she'd been conditioned or something.
Yes, it was cultural. It was, and that's often what we see in situations of harassment abuse, where there is cultural normalization of the behaviors, where they're led to believe that this is just part of the game and something I must endure to achieve the goals that I have. And that's why it's a multi-pronged approach to solving this, where one must actually address the cultural context as well as the health issues that you're seeing.
Okay. So I guess that makes more sense now. But I was going to say later on, like, you know, what do we do about this? But it makes more sense now, because I would just assume if someone punched me in the face, I would report it or something, but it would just be such... you know, and estranged to, you know, whatever you say, to anything that I've ever thought about, that I would do something about it. But it's hard to imagine being in that culture. And then the fact that even yourself seeing it, you didn't know what to do. So you start to sort of understand a little bit more, I guess, how these things can continue for so long.
For sure. And you said, you know, you feel powerless to do something often if there's no reporting mechanisms. There's also barriers to reporting. I mean, this might be someone who you admire very much and you don't want to see them get into trouble.
Yeah.
It also might be a revered individual in sport. It might be a coach or someone who is your mechanism or pathway to success. Yeah. And in addition, and often in sexual abuse and sexual harassment, there's a grooming process where the victim is actually groomed into silence. And made to feel guilty by the actual abuse itself. So there are many barriers to reporting. Sometimes people report and then they're not listened to. And in particular, if we take the Larry Nassar case, it has actually been reported 8 times before the 9th time when it was reported and dealt with. So individuals quickly learn that if others have reported it, and nothing has happened, then there's no point in me reporting it. So you know, you must have a reporting mechanism, but then you must have action to tell individuals that it's okay to report because something will happen.
So is that, you mentioned...
Pretty hard for people to report, you know, and then if nothing happens, it's like, you know, they've made themselves vulnerable for no end of result.
So did you say 2016 was the IOC? Is that the reporting mechanism that will cover sort of...
During the games. Yes. So a framework for safeguarding during the Olympic Games. 2016 Rio was the first Olympic Games with the safeguarding framework. And it has been every edition of the Olympic Games since then, both Youth Olympic Games and Olympic Games. And a lot of work being done in international federations with IOC support for implementing safeguarding frameworks at world championships, at international federation events. And then likewise with national Olympic committees, but also through down to national federations and national sport governing bodies. But that part's lagging. It will come.
All right. So does that mean, like, if you're just your high school basketball team or your university volleyball team or something, you just have to hope that each separate team, each separate university has a mechanism, like it's not centralized yet?
Right. So the work I'm doing, of course, is at the international federation level and world championships and whatnot. So how does the you know, the high school boy or girl in, you know, on the team, how do they get protection? And that's where the national Olympic committees can have some power within their own countries. And many countries have safeguarding policies that are applied to local sports within the national governance structure. So in Australia and in Canada, there are safeguarding policies and procedures governing sport. And I know in my country that if the national governing body, so let's say, as example, Gymnastics Canada, has to have the appropriate safeguarding place in place, or they don't get the federal funding from the government. So there's strings attached that the governments can then impose on national federations. In terms of university systems, they're governed a little differently and they're not under the national governing structure. And the university structure in several countries has a policies and procedures. So Canada does, I know the NC2A does as well. Not sure about Australia, but many countries don't have those things in place. And that's where it's a concern at the grassroots level of how do we protect our children who aren't at the international federation level. And children are even more vulnerable because they are in, they're powerless. They don't have a voice. They are unable to consent. They're often far away from family and there's no parental, you know, if they travel to their sport. So they're particularly vulnerable.
Okay. So what are the, just thinking general, like, so we've talked about punching in the face, which is obviously physical violence.
Right.
You know, it's not even physical abuse.
Well, it is physical abuse.
But I guess there's all the other, you know, what other sort of, because someone sent a tweet of an article written about a specific university volleyball team and how, you know, there'd been the normal dropout rate from year to year or during a course is like 7% and this university had 40%, you know, over and over, just turnover. And you know, it turns out there was this one coach that was doing all these things. So, you know, embarrassing the players in front of others, having like favorites and actually saying, you won't be a favorite because you're not one of the better players. That my favorites are the better players. So if you want to be a favorite, get better. You know, all this. So I'm just, it just opened my mind to like, hang on, what are all the different kind of, it's horrible to talk about it, but I guess we have to, all the different ways that people kind of victimized, I guess.
Yeah. I think, you know, it may be difficult to talk about, but I actually think it's good to talk about it because then we can empower the positives. By far the majority of people in sport are there for the right reasons and they're good individuals. So how can we empower the good individuals to influence those bad apples, so to speak? So you asked about the different forms of harassment and abuse, and the IOC has a framework in the 2016 publication of the consensus in the BJSM that it's a nice framework. It shows how the discriminations of cultural context lead to the types of violence, of non-accidental violence or harassment and abuse. And these cultural contexts may be differentials of power in terms of gender, sex, race, ethnicity, and indigeneity, financial age, ability, or disability. So all of these differentials of power lead to the what we consider the four types of harassment abuse. So you mentioned sexual already. That is one that's, you know, certainly garners a lot of emotion when it comes forward. So that's sexual harassment abuse. We talked about physical abuse, which my example was physical abuse, and it can be omission or commission. So punching someone is inappropriate, pushing someone off a 10-meter tower, but some are a little more subtle, such as, using exercise as punishment, having actually medical abuse is a form often of physical abuse, medication abuse, etc. Now, the third one is neglect, and that is usually under an act of omission. So you're in the sunshine, you ask for water, and I'm just going to walk away and not pay attention. So you could have some serious harm from that, from neglect or neglecting to allow someone to safeguard them from hazards in sports, say age inappropriate exercise or ability inappropriate exercise or unsafe equipment where you just neglect to bother about their safety. The final form of harassment and abuse is psychological abuse. And it's the most prominent and it's the one that really underpins all the other forms of abuse. I can't imagine someone being sexually abused without having a component of psychological abuse associated with it. So it really is, I've saved it to the last, but it is the most most important one because it underpins the other components of the other types. And then it's how it's actually, what's the mechanism? Is it through contact, non-contact, verbal, non-verbal, through cyber sources, bullying? I think it's a term most people know, and a fairly North American term is something called hazing, which is peer-to-peer abuse of initiation, often to a team, where there is, okay, you're new to the team, we're going to put you through the ropes. And that's called hazing. And that often has forced alcohol, forced sexual content, and often physical abuse as well. And then that, of course, leads to the impacts and the outcomes of what this means to athletes, or what they experience and what they suffer from. But not only does it impact the athlete, it also impacts the sport organization. We only have to look at the Larry Nassar case in the United States to understand the reputational damage, the financial damage, the loss of sponsorship, the loss of interest in USA Gymnastics. It's gymnastics, but it was also the university that was associated, as well as the U.S. Olympic Committee. So I think it's a difficult example to talk about, but it shows that the impacts were not only for the athletes, which was significant and is significant, but also for the organizations themselves, which is why sport organizations are starting to pay attention. Hopefully for the right reasons, that they're wanting to protect their asset, which is their athletes' health and well-being, but from a reputational damage as well.
So with the NASA case, I mean, it was very well known, but I guess could that almost be a exemplar case or something to think about what went wrong? So I guess I was just thinking, when you said it was reported seven times, is that the official reporting to the governing body? Because you can imagine how many times an athlete told their parent and the parent didn't say anything.
Often the parents were in the room. Often the parents were actually in the room and they didn't recognize what was going on. So the Nassar case is actually a good one for us to learn from. And many people have analyzed the Nassar case. Melissa McCraden is one. She's a Canadian woman who's done a lot of work in this area. And she's combed through, so let's say there was 165 or many women that were at the court case that were part of the army of survivors. And they gave victim impact statements of what it meant to them, what the abuse meant to them. And having analyzed that, it identified that the athletes had a strong desire to win at all costs. There was a desire to pursue and to win. They have no choice and no voice. And they were beholden to the sport organization. So the athletes were vulnerable. The second recipe, ingredient in the recipe was the gymnastics community themselves. We're saying that Dr. Nassar's the best. We're not going to listen to you if you report to us. And it was accepted. He was accepted by the community as being the best. So it was normalized. His treatments were normalized. So we had a community that endorsed what he did and a sport culture that had militaristic discipline, self-governed nature, devaluation of women and their athletes. So there was this distinct conflict of interest. We want them to win. They must do what we say. So high perpetrator inclination, motivation. He was highly motivated to abuse, but he was in a sport context that had low protection, working with athletes with high vulnerability. So those are the three components of the recipe. And it's in the publication, in the 2016 publication recipe. High perpetrator motivation in a sport culture with low protection, with high athlete vulnerability. So if we want to do something about it, we have to make sure our athletes aren't vulnerable and that our sport organizations have high protection policies so that the perpetrators with high motivation aren't allowed in or they're not allowed to perpetrate there. Wow. So it's like a formula. We can affect the end result by altering the two components of the ingredients.
Yeah, you were saying I guess you need
it's
all.
It's a perfect storm.
Do you need all three? You know what I mean? Like, do you need, it's obviously worse if you have all three, but you know what I mean? Do you need all the ingredients for it to sort of go so long, or I don't know?
No, you don't. I mean, there's different, what I call toxic cultures. And that's what I'm talking about, is failed leadership, where they fail to do what they need. But you can also have a toxic culture where it's just within the culture of the country or the tradition. We know in 2020, there was a publication by the Human Rights Watch called Taibatsu, Abuse of Children in Japan. And it was within the culture of sport in Japan that children had physical corporal punishment. They were beaten into submission, physical abuse. And that was the culture of the country. So that was accepted culture within the country. And then there's abuse of power, where one individual will just abuse their power over someone else, often coach athlete, or abusive coaching styles. And we have a good example of a Korean triathlete who actually committed suicide as a result of her abuse of her coach. In fact, that abuse of culture style had a serious price that was paid. In fact, that coach did end up going to jail, and the sport organization that failed to protect her as well had significant repercussions. And it's all about exploitation of the athletes, where they have no voice, and that's win at all costs.
So is it control? Like, you know how often with rape, for example, you know, people might think it's mainly sexual, and then other people say, hang on, it's mainly control of that person. Is it often that, and obviously it's complex, we've talked about all these different types of harassment and whatever, there's often the person just wants control. Is it?
It could be control. It could be that's how they were treated when they were an athlete. So it's learned behaviors or outside of sport. I mean, sport is a microcosm of society, and there's abuse and harassment within society, both in domestic and schools and churches. I mean, this is, unfortunately, the world's not as always a safe place. And sport was thought to be a safe place until people came forward with their stories and started to talk about some of the things. And, you know, parents trusted, like they trusted the church and school, they trusted sport, and they dropped their children off after school and knew that they'd be safe. But in fact, sport wasn't always safe for everyone. And by far, I want to reiterate, most sport is very safe. And it's a great place to be. And there's now very good safeguarding structures in place. And 99% of all individuals involved in sport, because it's not just coaches, right? It's abusers and perpetrators can be anyone in a position of power. It could be a physician, as we've talked about. It can be another athlete, as in the case of the Korean triathlete. There was other athletes also involved. So sport is, for most part, a safe place.
Oh, so that was, I must have missed that. I thought it was the coach that was, so the Korean person, it was another
coach
athlete.
And athletes. Coach and athletes.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So with the NASA, I'm just wondering, I saw bits and pieces of the trial and the victim statements that they were reading out, et cetera, but what was the final, like, why was it, what happened on the 7th, you know? And the other thing was, you know, when they said he was the best and they stuck with him, did people recognize that there was a problem and he was still the best and they kind of kept going? I guess that it happened to some extent.
I think he sold his technique as being the best. And his technique was actually sexually abusing young women. And he's saying this is to improve their back pain. Well, as a physician, when I teach a pars, when I treat a pars intercircularis stress fracture, which I often see in gymnastics, or a lumbar strain, I don't have to penetrate the vagina or the anus to actually treat that injury. It's not standard of care, but he had people around him believing that this was his standard of care. And he, you know, he was using the guise of medicine to say, I'm an expert in this. I have special skills and this is what I do. So that's when I said, your parents were often in the room. They just didn't recognize.
And they knew he was really literally doing that. He wasn't, you know, it's getting a bit nitty gritty, but they knew he wasn't actually massaging the top of the groins, for example. They actually knew he was doing that. Okay.
And thought that that was acceptable because he was the best.
Okay.
So, you know, that's, he was using that position of power and prestige to abuse young girls who were very vulnerable.
And I guess also, you know, we talked about athletes wanting to do the best and win medals and things, but I guess it gets gray where you've got the parents also want their child to be a star. And even if they think, oh, this doesn't look quite right, they might be even subconsciously, you know what I mean? Like not wanting to see.
Sure, powerless as well, right?
Or not wanting to see, you know, like wanting to,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Subconsciously, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the prevalence? I know you said 99%, but do we have an idea? And I'm sure it's underreported, that's very clear, but do we have an idea? Or it's just, again, it's too gray. You might say, okay, what's the prevalence of sexual abuse? What's the prevalence of this and that? Bullying?
Yeah. Well, we do have some studies. And I'll point the fingers at my own country first. 2019, there was a survey of Canadian athletes, international level, national level, so very high, about 1,000 athletes, so a large data set. 59% reported psychological abuse, 67% neglect, 20% sexual harassment, 12% physical. So this is
That's too quick for my brain. I've got to think. What was that again? 59%
psychological.
It's a lot to take in. Psychological. Okay.
67% neglect. So neglecting to look after their safety. Mm-hmm. 20% sexual harassment.
Okay.
And 12% physical abuse. So that's a Canadian study. We also have studies from Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands, psychological abuse, so retrospective self-report in people who've left sports. So there's perhaps some recall bias, 72% psychological, 25% physical, 31% sexual. The challenge we have is that our methodology isn't uniform. So sometimes we're comparing apples and oranges in these studies, depending on how people define the terms. There's a very good study from Canada, which is a prospective study of youth athletes in Quebec. So lower level, but youth athletes. 2 to 8% for children have an incidence. So over the time period of the study of new onset of victims of sexual abuse, 2012 study. So just some, we do know that homophobia, 81% of 10,000 experienced homophobia in sport, either verbal, physical, and 70% said they felt unsafe. So that's a 2015 study. So it's quite high that people who identify as LGBTQ are at particular vulnerability within the sport context. And we also know that the disabled athlete have higher rates of harassment and abuse, 31% in the disabled in one study in 2000, 31% in the disabled population versus 9% in the able-bodied population in this particular study. So it's not rare. And if we think of the prevalence of some other sport medicine issues we see, that's probably more common than some of the issues we see.
And
if we don't have it in our practice, I think we're missing it. So we should be having our eyes wide open is my message to the listeners and watchers today.
So, you know, you said at one point, you know, we tend to think sport, we don't have to worry about it in sport, but it almost feels like that would be higher than, those numbers would be higher than in a, you know, job environment or something. Is that right?
So the question is it more than in the general population?
Yeah, exactly.
Say in domestic abuse or in school or whatnot. And it probably is a little bit because sport has not had the safeguards in place that say education or the church systems have had. They're a little further ahead, I think, in terms of safeguarding. So I think we're a little bit behind, but we need to know so much more. I mean, we're scratching the surface in terms of what we know. We know a little bit about prevalence, but what is the context around that? What's the literature on perpetrators? We have some on perpetrators. We have some on the culture, but you know, there's so much more that we need to know and a little bit more on impacts. I mean, we have a nice study from Sweden looking at the impacts of abuse and the interesting correlation between sexual abuse and non-sport related injury and physical abuse such as situated with sport related vulnerability and then also suicide risk. So, you know, we need to learn a lot more, but there is these associations with impacts which is starting to come out as well.
So it's a physical abuse with non-sport related injuries. Is that what you said?
Physical abuse with a higher likelihood of sport related injury.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, okay.
Sexual abuse. Yeah. No, but it's the association and correlation in this study. And sexual abuse, which was females of 16% and males of 4% within this population of high elite level athletics, so track and field athletes in Sweden, that was their prevalence of sexual abuse. And there was a statistically significant correlation with non-sport related injury for the women.
Okay.
So
I was just thinking it must get grey sometimes, because I was just thinking with you when you mentioned track and field. So if a coach was getting an athlete to train, you know, like harder than most people would think, you know, is, you know, because everyone's always has different, you know, some people think you should do lots of low intensity exercise and people think you should do high intensity intervals. Some people think a mix of, it's probably a hard one, isn't it? If you've got, because, you know, coaches sometimes will be like, well, let's train the crap out of these runners and, you know, 3% will make it and they'll end up, you know, in the national team and the others will drop
out.
That's
one approach.
Abuse or not? Exactly.
Yeah. So that's a very good question. Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's all in how you define what this is. And you know, there's some that I think that you and I can agree is very, very clear cut. Punching an athlete in the face, raping someone, that's very clear. So I think none of us have any difficulty in defining that as being wrong. And what you're describing is that or not? So some people call that a gray area, and is it or not? And I think it depends on the cultural context. If this is a high performing elite sport where training hard is part of the program, everybody understands what that is. The coach is respectful about it. Everybody knows what it is. I don't consider that abuse. And probably the athletes involved don't consider that abuse. But if I am forced to do 10 times as much than the other 9 people on the team and I'm injured and then I'm forced to do more and I'm not allowed to have water or breaks and I'm forced to train when I'm injured, then that is abuse. So I think it depends on the context
and the motive
and how
it,
and the motives. Yes. And how it's done. Right. So, so much of it is around perception, I suppose.
You mentioned the homophobic. I saw something again on Twitter the other day. I think it was a study in Australia where they had, 50%. They looked at homophobia in youth sports. And it was like 50% of participants had heard a homophobic slur in the last 2 weeks. And then they got a professional athlete or professional athletes to come in and talk to them. Obviously, it was, I'm assuming it was about not being homophobic in sport. And it went up to 59%. Afterwards, so it was. I didn't read the paper. I just saw the. So right, it was almost right. Like some. It's almost like some of the people that hadn't been doing it went, oh, I didn't realize it was. Everyone was doing that. Maybe I should do it as well or something. It's really weird.
Or maybe they just didn't report it and didn't realize it was wrong, right? So I think that's more likely the interpretation is that they didn't recognize that the slurs that they were hearing were actually not okay. That was just part of the sport, so they weren't reporting it. And then after they had this realization session that, you know, really sport should be a safe place for everyone, where everyone is welcome and it doesn't matter what your sexual orientation is, that they maybe recognized it. And so the increase in reporting isn't that it's all of a sudden worse. It's that people are recognizing, oh, that isn't okay. So in fact, we often see when safeguardings and reporting mechanisms come into place that the numbers go up and you think, no, you know, have we caused it to go up? And the answer is no, we haven't caused it. It was always there. We just now recognize and are giving people an avenue or a voice with which they can then report it.
That's tricky for your research then when you, like I said, when you do studies and it goes the wrong way, you know.
Yes, indeed. But in fact, yeah, I don't worry that things go up because I think, wow, people are now able to report and feel comfortable and confident that there won't be negative repercussions and that we'll be doing something about it. So that's okay.
Yeah, but exactly. But which is a great way to think. But, you know, if you're doing an intervention, like right. I said, you want to have a professional athlete talk to these young people about homophobia and the effects it can have. And you do your pre and post and it goes the wrong way. You know what I mean?
But, yes. Well, it depends on how you interpret it. And I like the way I interpreted it.
I do too. Now, the other one, I guess, I don't know, because there's a long list of harassments and abuse, is, you know, body fat levels, body image, which is obviously a big one.
Yeah. I did a study at the World Championships, FINA World Championships in Korea. In 2019 of aquatic, so diving, water polo, synchro swimming or artistic swimming water polo. Did I say that one? Anyway, the five disciplines of FINA aquatics. And I asked them, had they themselves experienced, and I gave 13 different examples of different forms of abuse. Had they experienced it? Had they seen it in others? And who was the perpetrator? And did they report it? And our number one, 15% had personally experienced harassment abuse in this cohort. and 9% had witnessed it in others. The most common type of abuse that was reported, 40% of that total abuse that was reported, was experienced unwanted comments about their body appearance. And this is in particular in sports that aren't, they're not wearing very much, so you can't hide anything in those bathing suits. And where in all of these sports, all of the ones except, I suppose, water polo, where body shape is directly impacting your sport result. So in the judge sports, it's the aesthetic look that coaches are going for. And in swimming, the leaner you are, the faster you go. So body weight and appearance and or weight is dependent upon sport performance. So that's a very high rate of body shaming perceived by the athletes as a form of harassment and abuse. So it is a concern. And in fact, one of the papers that I have in review right now are guidelines on body composition measurement in elite sport. We know that having ideal body composition for performance is an important part of the elite sport paradigm. But how can we do it so that it is not perceived by the athletes as being abusive, and where it's done in a safe manner that we don't develop things like REDS? So, you know, you alluded to the fact that I'm writing on REDS. You think, oh, that's so different from harassment and abuse. And in fact, here we go. 40% of the athletes that I'm responsible for at World Championships were having body shaming around their body composition. And many of them, I'm sure, had REDS, although I didn't measure them in this cohort. So, it's really important that we think about how and what we do with elite athletes to understand their perception and how can we do that safely. You know, who has this health data? So who has access to that? Is it secure? How is it measured? Are we screening our athletes to make sure they're safe for body composition? Like, have they got an eating disorder that we just don't know about? Should we be screening them? And how do we measure them? What measurement tools do we use? Are they safe tools? Are they not safe? Are they, good quality tools? And how and when are we measuring these folks? Who has access to the data? So I'm not saying don't do body composition. It's a very important part. I looked after the elite marathon runners and elite middle long distance runners. Body composition is really important to performance, but it's how you do it that makes the difference between harassment, abuse, and performance enhancement, which is what we want. Safe, healthy performance enhancement without abuse or illness or injury, which are the outcomes of erroneous body composition manipulation.
Okay, so with the just if we could just explain what REDS for people that haven't seen Trent Stellingworth's podcast, we just explain what REDS is again, and then how it fits in with what you were just saying.
Sorry, there is a connection there. So relative energy deficiency in sport is a syndrome of impaired physiological functioning of many body systems, including the sexual function, so low testosterone and sexual function in men, amenorrhea in women. Affects bone health, so that might be stress fractures, osteopenia, osteoporosis, but also cardiovascular function through abnormal lipids, other endocrinological systems, cortisol, thyroid, can also affect resting metabolic rate, mental health, sleep disturbances, pelvic floor dysfunction, and can also impair performance through many mechanisms. And it's actually the body is quite a complex system with interactions, and it is a system that we have studied quite carefully. Originally started as the female athlete triad, and in 2014 expanded to include men. So the name was changed from the female athlete triad to relative energy deficiency in sport, because the actual cause is actually the energy deficiency. The outcomes are related to that energy deficiency. So I'd ask your listeners, watchers, to stay tuned to the British Journal of Sport Medicine in likely the July 2023. There will be an updated IOC consensus with about 8 supportive papers that will be published on this topic to really represent and demonstrate the vast expansion of science in the field. And we'll be changing some of our models and clinical assessment tools related to REDS. Now, the connection between REDS and harassment and abuse that I was talking about is that in order for some athletes to obtain the body composition required for elite performance or to enhance performance to its maximum, it can be done, and what, to use Trent's word, the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good way is done where it's done, where there's thoughtful scientific insight, oversight, and with data protection, and done thoughtfully and appropriately with data protection. What I see in this cohort that I studied at the FINA World Championships is that often it's done with body shaming. It's done with inappropriate requirements of weight loss that aren't appropriate for someone's genetic physique. It may be done at the last minute, where it can't be done gradually over time in a safe manner. So it's done too quickly. And that's when I see people running into reds, where they have stress fractures, they have the mental health problems. We see them in people who cycle around weight categorizations, where they need to weigh in and they try to lose 10 pounds the night before the weigh-in. We had one athlete in Beijing Olympic Games lose too much weight. He was trying to lose about 10 kilos prior to his weigh-in, and he ended up with rhabdomyolysis and dialysis, missed his Olympic Games because of his unsafe weight loss practices. Mm-hmm. So that's the ugly, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Yeah. But it not only can lead to health implications, but it can also lead to mental health implications and harassment and abuse. So that was the connection between reds and harassment and abuse.
Okay. So it's good. You just mentioned mental health, and naturally everything we've been talking about pretty much is impacting. But I guess it's how much impact it has. And that's going to be determined on how much resilience the person has and their upbringing, and, you know, if they have a supportive environment at home and all sorts of things like that. But I guess I'm wondering, how do these mental health issues, appear? Are they higher prevalence than the general population? Is it different in some way?
Those are very good questions. We do know, and this study I did at FINA World Championships, just to explain, at the same time that I asked them about their experience with harassment and abuse, I asked them about depression and eating disorders. And not surprisingly, those who had experienced harassment abuse had statistically significant higher reporting of both depression and eating disorders. So to give an example, that harassment abuse does have psychological impact. And in particular, it showed out in this cohort. But we know it from other studies as well, that the psychological impact of harassment abuse can be significant, affecting self-esteem, social function, like academic performance, work performance, body image. Eating disorders are often manifested from harassment abuse, self-harm, depression, anxiety, substance use, and suicide. So these are reported in the literature. And in fact, when the analysis is done of the victim impact statements, I'm just pulling up my data here, I think it was around 70% of the athletes that were giving victim impact statements reported mental health implications that have lasted well beyond the period of the harassment abuse. So the impacts don't end when the abuse ends.
No.
Impacts may continue. There's a very nice study done in Belgium and Germany of retired athletes. And not only did the athletes who reported harassment abuse had more mental health problems than the general population, they reported a lower quality of life as well.
Okay.
So you think, okay, the abuse is over, they're fine now.
Mm.
No. And we know that from outside of sport, dealing with survivors of domestic abuse from other traumas, that once the trauma is over, the impacts continue. So in fact, that's where I believe strongly that we as sport medicine physicians and other members of the athlete health and performance team, so physios, massage, mental health workers, those of us who are in the circle of care, to use the term of the athlete health and performance team, we have a duty to understand our role in protecting and supporting and treating athletes who have been survivors of harassment abuse, either inside or outside of sport, because in fact, our athletes may come to sport as a safe place from domestic abuse. So we should have trauma-informed skills. We should know how to recognize harassment abuse. We should know how to manage a disclosure, and we should know how to treat and support an athlete. So those are three things. No one's going to book an appointment to see you on Tuesday morning to talk about harassment abuse. I can tell you that right now. They don't. Mm-hmm. They're going to come in with mental health problems. They're going to come in because the coach is making them come in because they're not performing. They're going to come in because they're a disruptive athlete. They might come in with an injury that doesn't make sense, or they might be the one who comes in injured over and over again, like the risk taker. Now, not every risk taker is going to be harassed or abused, but I tell you, if you start to see these things, if you see mental health presentations, you must ask about a history of harassment and abuse. If you see injuries that don't make sense, injuries that aren't getting better when they should be getting better, it doesn't hurt to ask, how's it going at sport? Are you having fun? Sometimes in this situation, others have had harassment and abuse, and they were using the treatment time to avoid going back to sport. If this could be you, please feel free to talk to me about it. I am safe and I will help you. Mm-hmm. That's all you have to say. And then they may not talk about you then. They may wait a month or two or a year or two, but they know that you're a safe place. All you have to do is open the door. And if you're wrong, all they've heard is that you care for them. You've not caused any harm, that you care for them. So it is okay to approach it that way with them. I think one of my most concerning cases I had was a young girl, and her knee injury didn't quite make sense. So we did a little bit of treatment, wasn't getting better. And it turns out, she was a gymnast. She was coming to treatment after school instead of going home to where her stepfather was abusing her. And if she came to treatment after school, her mother would pick her up from treatment and then go home, and she wouldn't be abused. So, you know, we have to be cognizant that when we're in sport medicine, that our individuals have lives outside of the playing field where we may be interacting in a different way. The other thing is, I really encourage sports physicians and the entire entourage of athlete and health performance, don't forget about treating the teammates and other people in the sport context. Whereas one athlete, I had one athlete who was harassed, abused, didn't really affect them very much. I don't know for what reasons, maybe as you say, home supports, the resilience, they were fine. But it was a teammate that I spent more time with having impacts of witnessing it. And they actually left sport and had some significant mental health problems from having witnessed it, as opposed to actually having experienced it. So please don't forget that that teammate has others that really care for them. Or it might be, you know, some other member of the entourage who are really impacted by it as well. So everyone out there, please make sure you know how to recognize the signs and symptoms. How do you manage a disclosure, and how do you treat and support someone who is then, told their story? Most importantly, please report it. Please act, because if they tell you, first of all, it's really hard for them to talk. It's a lot of bravery. I tell you, they've had sleepless nights deciding whether to come and talk to you. So acknowledge their bravery. Put your pen down, stop, turn and look at them. Give them the time and space. Let them talk. You're going to be late. You're going to be home late that night. It's okay. But just stop and listen. Acknowledge their bravery. Don't denigrate the perpetrator, because it might be someone important to them. Listen, take notes, and then you must stop it. Because if they told you and then you don't do anything, then that's just told them that you agree that it's okay. And you actually compound the trauma, psychological trauma. So report it, to the public authorities, if it's an underage child, if it's sexual abuse, that whatever is the laws in your country, but if not through to the sport organizations, that of course your sport organizations should have reporting mechanisms in place. If you're working with a sport team, make sure they have reporting mechanisms and report it and stop it so that that athlete knows that they've had a result of coming forward.
And depending on the abuse, a lot of these things are actually like a police matter, aren't they? So if you feel like if someone gets punched in the face or sexual abuse, that is if you feel like you're not getting, response from the coach or the federation, that's a police matter as well, assuming they will act, of course.
Well, it could be, but we know from domestic situations of rape, that the number of cases that actually, come to the point where that actually happens to be successful, it's pretty low. But yes, I mean, the sexual abuse of an underage child is a reportable offense in most countries. So that one, you're obligated by law to report that. The rest is really up to the survivor, or I like to call them survivors, not victims, but the individual whether or not they wish to press charges. And by far, most of them don't press criminal charges, but they, you know, wanted to stop. So there's other mechanisms beyond the criminal court system, which is never really very effective.
And do you think things are actually, you know, trending the right way, are getting better? It sounds like if there's more regulations and more sort of consensus statements, and you'd like to think it's moving better.
Yeah, I'm an eternal optimist. I do think that things are getting better. I'd like to believe that the work that's being done is making a difference. And I do believe that it is. I spoke a little while ago, a couple of years ago, to a woman from Japan, and she said, "I just have to thank you, Dr. Manager." And I said, "For what?" And she said, "Because of the IOC's consensus statement, it gave me the power to go to my National Olympic Committee and put in safeguarding procedures." She said, "I've been trying for 10 years and, you know, to deaf ears. But because of the statement, I was able to do so." So, that was really encouraging to me. I worked with a woman last summer and we had a lovely conversation. She's a retired Olympic basketball player. And then she goes, "You know, I have to thank you." I said, "What for?" She goes, "Well, I was part of a team where our coach slept with each one of us. It was forced. We were not allowed on the team if we didn't have sex with the coach. And it's because of the work that you've done with the IOC that we've been able to go back to our NOC and get the coach fired." She said, "I don't want other girls to go through what I had to live through to be on that Olympic team." So, I mean, these are just anecdotes that I'm hearing. So, you know, they're just small anecdotes that are very powerful to me as an individual to think, okay, I still have more work to do. There's lots of things we have to do. Thank you for having this on the podcast today, that we will reach more people. But I want to empower people listening and watching today that, in fact, you have a role to play. You have a role to play on the individual basis with your athletes, recognizing, reporting, supporting. That's a really important role. But you have another role to play where you can advocate to make sure that your sport organizations that you're working with have safeguarding mechanisms in place, policies, procedures. And physicians, as physicians, we are a strong voice in sport organizations. We can encourage, and, you know, not pointing fingers, but saying, you know, we need better safeguarding policies. And here's an example of one. We have examples in our papers. We have examples on the IOC website. Here's an example of a policy that you can put in place. So we make sure that our athletes under our care have those policies and procedures. As physicians, we also give education. We give talks on how to do knee prevention exercises. We can give talks on eating disorders. We can give talks on empowering the athlete voice and protection against harassment and abuse. So we have a role as an advocate. We have a role as an educator. And we have a role as a clinician. We also have a role in research. So if you're not a researcher, participate in projects that come your way. If you're a researcher, please help us answer some of the research gaps in the area. So as physicians, we have an important role to play in many domains other than, I'm going to say, just treating our athletes. It's the very important part of, recognizing, reporting, and treating. But we have a role beyond that. So we aren't powerless to put our hands up and say, "Oh, dear, this is awful." We have a role that we can play.
I can see that you're incredibly, you know, this really affects you and you're empathetic and you know, it's great and it's amazing. But I wonder if the average physician, you know, is, and how much time do they often have, you know, you're saying, "Oh, how's your sport going?" You know what I mean? I don't know if it's like, so it depends on the, if it's a sports medicine doctor, it might be different. But here in Australia, I think we say that an appointment with a general practitioner, I think in America and Canada, I think physician, 7 minutes on average. Just wondering, you know, and also how do the physicians, doctors, do they need training? Are they getting training? Because I guess they have to know everything. They're generalists, aren't they? They have to know everything about everything.
Sure. Almost. Well, that's a very good question you ask, Glenn. And I hope that physicians are training that. I'm the dean of a medical school, and I can tell you my physicians are trained in trauma-informed care. And so trauma-informed care, and for those who might not know that term, it's the four R's of trauma-informed care. And the first R is recognizing that it's widespread, realizing it's widespread, recognizing the signs and symptoms, responding to it, and then resisting re-traumatization. So I'll say them again in case I went too quickly. Realizing that trauma is common in society. recognizing the signs and symptoms of trauma in other people. So again, you know, one who behaves different, mental health problems, those recognition things. The third one is responding to it, knowing the policies and procedures and how to help. And the fourth one is resisting re-traumatization. So by that meaning, some of the things I've talked about, you know, not reporting, that's re-traumatizing someone, using language that's re-traumatizing. So making sure that physicians have, and not only physicians, physiotherapists, massage therapists, people that work with athletes have this trauma-informed care. I'm doing a study right now, or shall I say, about to launch a study where I'm actually asking sport docs to respond to a survey. And I'm asking them, you know, what's their knowledge? It's not a knowledge test, but what's their belief and self-perception of their knowledge of harassment abuse? And what's their self-perception of their training in how to recognize, respond, and treat athletes with this that have been survivors of harassment and abuse? And so I want to learn from physicians around the world, what their perception of their comfort level, knowledge, comfort level, and skills. And depending on what we find from this, then that might instigate direct development of curriculum that we can then disseminate globally on how to improve the competence of sport medicine physicians to prevent, recognize, respond to, and treat.
Right.
So stay tuned for this. This survey will be coming out in social media probably in late March, early April. We have the protocol ready. We're going to develop some social media promotions in March, piloted in March in a small pilot group, and then we'll disseminate it in April, collect data through till July, and then analyze in the fall and come up with outcomes based on what our findings are.
Right. Okay. You've mentioned that, I know you haven't done that one yet, but you've mentioned a couple of big papers and position statements and things. So I might get you to just send those through to me and I'll put it under the, you know, the show notes or whatever, so people can look them up. I'd like to really thank you for coming on. I mean, you're a sports medicine doctor. You just said you're the dean of the medical school and you're doing your own research. So you must be slightly busy, and I'm assuming you've got a life outside of academia and sports medicine as well. So thank you very much for taking the time on this very important issue. Before I let you go, is there anything that you think we need to chat about we haven't sort of covered yet? Or
No, I don't think so. I just want to thank you for highlighting this topic today and for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to chat about something I'm passionate about, and hoping that I can influence her others to also act and respond. So thank you for the opportunity.
Right, but before I let you go, I like to do this thing where I just do a bit of a takeaway messages, you know, from we've talked about a lot of things. It might be a bit of a hard one to say, because often it's, you know, straight sort of you know, effective carbohydrate on exercise performance. You say, okay, drink this much and this often. But, you know, is there takeaway messages? It might be the 4 hours, was it? The 4 hours, but yeah.
Yeah, it might be. I think one of the main takeaways is that as listeners to this, you have the power to act. And you also have the duty of care to act. So if you feel not well equipped with the skills, get the skills. There's training courses that you can do. If you have the skills, please use them. Please be vigilant when you're seeing athletes that things aren't quite adding up. And don't be afraid to ask. Be a safe space. Make sure you know your reporting mechanisms and have your multidisciplinary team around you that's going to help you support that individual. I can't do it alone as a sports doc. I need my mental health worker to work with me. I often need the physiotherapist or manual therapist to help respond to any injuries that have occurred because of the process. So who's your multidisciplinary team that's going to support that athlete, their teammates, and their family through this journey? So I guess the bottom line, just do it, to use a Nike slogan. You know, please act.
Right. And just before we go, I just wanted to make sure everyone remembers this bit that you said, that when the abuse finishes, it doesn't mean the mental health, because, you know, we know from the NASA and from even, you know, sometimes they don't even realize it was a problem or they've blocked it out for like 20 years or, the damage that's been done is lifelong. You know, they've got to work on fixing it. Yep. So that's an important one. So anyway, thank you very, very much for coming on, and I'll see you around. Maybe in Australia.
Maybe next time in Australia.
Okay,
thank you.
See you. Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.